of Speaking, a monthly podcast on the spoken word. Episode number 78, July 2024. Transatlantic and Old Movie Dialects, a conversation with Barry Krynick. Hello, Paul Meyer here. A particularly loyal fan of this podcast, who frequently suggests topics and guests, reminded me of this old riddle. What do you call a person who speaks three languages? Trilingual. What do you call a person who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call a person who speaks only one language? An American. That's less and less true as time goes on. The number of multilingual speakers in the US is climbing steeply, I've learned. Just finished my June masterclass series. I taught the transatlantic dialect, the subject of today's podcast, for the first time, as part of my class on RP, Cockney, Estuary, and Multicultural London English. Thanks for making it so much fun, guys. And now, if you're listening to this podcast during the first week of July 2024, I still have some spaces in my Dialects of the British Isles and my Coaching Accent Modification classes. They begin July 6th and 7th, respectively. See the Zoom Masterclasses with Paul tab under the Coaching tab on the paulmeyer.com menu bar. And watch that space for future masterclasses. Now, our old favourite, Guess That Accent. Last time I played this clip from the Idea Archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
My dear, today I'm driving taxi, it's not busy, I'm so tired. Trying to make money, stress out there, angry with it, but I'm all right. I come home, I'm happy. Ayo, today yeah, I'm Sunday also later. Yeah, so me go walk here. Yeah. I'm hard working. Me walk you gonna. Me no make money now. Nah. Me bella there. Yeah. I wish me rich married now. Nah. Me no walk, Mr. Blouse.
That's a tough one, isn't it? Did you guess Papua New Guinea by any chance? If so, I'm hugely impressed. It was Idea's Papua New Guinea 2. Wasn't her speaking pidgin fascinating? We must do a podcast on Creoles and pigeons. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then Australia, Oceania, then Papua New Guinea. The sample was recorded by Wendy Mock under the supervision of Associate Editor Linda Nichols-Gidley. Thanks again, Linda. Now, this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend his formative years?
When I pick up Shakespeare, I know sometimes it's a little bit, maybe a little bit confusing sometimes, but it's like gold. When you finally like get it and click it, it's like, oh my God, like how the hell did he say that and put that so beautifully? I mean, if it's just like talking about how gorgeous, say, Juliet is, how she says how boundless her love is for Romeo. You know, anything else, and I know there's other great writers too, but anything else just seems to pale in comparison.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. Now, you've heard me say this before, but if you aren't listening to me on paulmeyer.com, switch over now. Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab, then click episode number 78. Lots of details about our guest and clips of everything we discussed today. You won't find this on any other podcast channel. My guest this month is Barry Krynick. She's an actor, writer, and prolific Audi award-winning audiobook narrator. She's also one of Idea's wonderful editors. Joining me again to talk with Barry is Cameron Meyer, film critic and historian, vice president of Paul Meyer Dialect Services, executive editor of Idea, and co-producer of this podcast. And as you know by now, he's my son. Thanks for joining me again, Cameron.
Great to be here.
And welcome, Barry.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on The Queen of 14th Street. Amazing. The story of Eva Le Gallienne. Is it true to say a name only for theatre buffs today, perhaps, but a huge star in her day? Yeah, true?
Yes, absolutely. And even many theatre buffs today have not heard of her, which is one of the reasons I wanted to write about her, because everyone who is a lover of the theatre should know her story.
Tell us more about her and what drew you to tell her story in your wonderful audio drama, The Queen of 14th Street.
Thank you. Well, she was one of the most accomplished theater artists of the 20th century, and she really was all round. She was an actor, a director, a producer, a translator, and a writer. She did some design at various points. About the only thing she didn't do in the theater was to write an original play, interestingly enough. But she was incredibly multifaceted, had a decades-long career. She was born in London in 1899. Her mother was a Danish journalist and her father was an English poet. Her parents split when she was three, and she moved with her mother to Paris. And her mother being from Copenhagen, Eva spent a lot of her childhood kind of bouncing between Paris, Copenhagen, and England. So she was trilingual from the age of nothing.
Yes.
Grew up in Paris attending lots and lots of theater. They couldn't afford to have really great seats, but they would go sit in what she called the peanut gallery. And she saw Sarah Bernhardt when she was just 7 years old. And that inspired her to want to devote her life to the theater. Fast forwarding a bit, she ended up back in London at age 14, made her West End debut as a page for Constance Collier, who was a very famous actress at that time who mentored her. Briefly attended Trees Academy, which is now the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and then made her West End debut as a Cockney servant and was an overnight sensation. And then followed her sense of adventure at age 16 to New York. She and her mother moved to New York, seeking broader theatrical horizons. They had a family friend who was in the theater and was going to introduce her to, introduce her to the Broadway scene. That's all the theater that was in New York at that time was Broadway. And she became a Broadway star at 21. By 24, she was a national celebrity, as theater actors could be at that time, because they not only performed on Broadway, but toured nationally. And then in 1926, at the age of 27, she founded the Civic Repertory Theater down on West 14th Street.
Hence the title of the play.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And it was New York's first classical repertory theater. And it was in the tradition of the theaters that she had grown up attending in Europe, which were, those were government subsidized. She was very surprised when she came to this country and discovered that theater here was only show business, not art, that it was not government subsidized. So she got her theater subsidized by wealthy donors. So it was nonprofit, and they had a resident acting company who were guaranteed a certain number of weeks each year of work. And they produced plays in true repertory style. So in rotation, a single company of actors performing a wide variety of plays, sometimes a different play every night of the week.
That was the traditional route into the theater when I was trained. Unfortunately, I never experienced the rep scene of being cast on a weekly basis until I was with the BBC when we were in the drama repertory company. And that was the same thing. We were a company of 50 men and 50 women and were, you know, played as cast, get your scripts Monday morning. Yeah. So that's the closest I ever came to the true rep scene.
She had 37 plays in the repertory by the time the Civic Rep was sadly killed off by the Depression in 1933-34. But she ran it successfully for 7 years as lead actor, director, and producer. She did everything, which was pretty amazing. And then she went on to have decades more of a career as an actor, a director, etc. She never gave up her dream of what she called a people's theater. And a central part of that dream was that every city in America should have a theater for the people, as she put it, because her emphasis was on affordability, that theater should be accessible to anyone who wanted to see it, so that she used to say the standard must be high, but the prices must be low. And that dream, to a certain extent, came true in the 50s, 60s, 70s when the regional theater movement took off. And she doesn't get quite enough credit for having prefigured that nonprofit theater movement by a couple of decades. And she died in 1991 at the age of 92. So she lived for most of the 20th century.
As a neighbor of yours in Connecticut, right?
Sort of, yes. She had a house in Weston. I grew up in Hartford, which is about an hour north of Weston, and Weston is about an hour and a half from New York City. So,
Well, that's an amazing story, and a story very, very worth telling for sure. And we're going to recommend it highly to our listeners. Give us a quick guide to how you can access the Queen of 14th Street.
Sure. So it's a 90-minute audio drama, and you can get it wherever audiobooks are sold. So that's Audible, Apple Books, Spotify, Google Play, Kobo, Libro FM, etc. Literally anywhere you might download an audiobook, you can find The Queen of 14th Street.
Let's hear the woman herself, which I'm sure you used as a
as
a research tool. This is a YouTube interview with Dick Cavett, 1977. I'm going to play a little bit where she's talking about Sarah Bernhardt and Eleonora Dusan.
Seen, though there's no comparison between that and the films that Madame Sarah made.
Is there any way you can describe what it was about Duse that moved you so? Did she have any analyzable secret or craft or technique?
I don't think so. She had enormous craft, but she had such a technique. It was so great that you thought she didn't have any. You know, this is the greatest of
technique
all.
Technique that effaces itself or whatever.
You just didn't think she had. And people used to say that. They used to say she hasn't got any technique. Whereas she had the most consummate technique that I've ever seen. Even greater than Sarah's, which was pretty great too. Only hers was visible, whereas Duse's was not.
I prefer the latter.
So do I.
Isn't that great? How did this piece inform your development of the character?
Oh my goodness, this was one of the best resources because it's actually a video. There's not a huge amount of video footage of Legie, as she was called by people who knew her. So this was the first video I ever saw of her because it's been on YouTube for quite some time. And to get to see her mannerisms, she was 78 at this point when this was recorded and I was playing her. I play her in my audio play from age 7 to 34. But still, just to see the way she moved her hands, the way she tilted her head, and then certainly the sound of her voice, which I recreated as faithfully as possible.
Well, let's see how well you did, which I think is tremendous. I'm going to play the first clip that you sent us from that.
Was founded 6 years ago in 1926. Ah, damn! Where have you been?
Good morning to you, too.
Mimsy.
I was on the telephone, Eva. Mrs. Bach is wiring us some more money.
Oh, thank God. We need our loyal patrons more than ever.
You're telling me. If this depression goes on much longer, we'll be sunk.
I've been trying to write this blasted fundraising letter. I'm so tired of begging and pleading.
You used to say, if I'm prepared to give up
9/10 of my earning capacity to this theater, surely you can give me $10,000. Those were the days. Did you see the accounting I did up for Alice in Wonderland?
Yes.
What?
Nothing.
It'll keep us afloat.
If it doesn't bankrupt us first.
So who's your Mimsy?
Playing Mimsy is an actress named Elizabeth Rogers.
Wonderful. This is sounding great. Just like the radio drama that I cut my teeth on. Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
So I'm fascinated by the segmental sounds, the vowels, the consonants, and the prosody. How did this inform your approach to her accent? Is this entirely RP? Did you conceive of this as someone with an American influence on her? How did that work out?
First of all, this was the first time that I had ever had to. Well, I didn't have to. I chose to. I wanted to recreate her voice as faithfully as possible so that if anyone listens to the audio play and then says, is that how she really sounded? They can go and listen to a clip like the one you just played and hopefully say, well, yes. So this was the first time I had tried to recreate a specific person's voice. I do a lot of dialect work in my audiobook narration, in my stage acting, and obviously as a dialect coach.
Yes.
But the addition of also considering the sound of somebody's voice, the placement and the pitch and intonation and pacing and all of those things was really fascinating. But I started with her accent. And what I did, rather than seeing it as a derivative of any accent in particular, is I analyzed it the way I would if I were teaching myself an accent that I didn't know at all. So I listened to, there's a wonderful interview that she did in 1964 or 65 with Studs Terkel, which you can find online actually at the Studs Terkel archive. And it's 45 minutes long. That was a great resource because it's just so much. I think she was in her 60s by that point, but again, a voice is a voice. And I played that and I wrote down all the sound changes that I detected. And when I say sound changes, I mean from my native accent to hers, right? So what's the difference between the way I speak and the way she speaks? Mm-hmm. And what resulted, I think, or I mean, what her accent sounds like to me is a kind of hybrid of RP and what I was taught in school as standard American, what some folks call transatlantic, that old-fashioned Northeastern American dialect that she would have heard slash learned or absorbed when she arrived in this country in 1915, mm-hmm. plus the influences of her European childhood. So just a few kind of specifics that I found particularly fascinating. Her "ah" sound, as in the word back or hat, tilts backward toward an "eh." It doesn't go all the way there.
Yes, I'm going back home.
Yes, so that is a characteristic of very old-fashioned RP, and she doesn't go all the way there. When I say it, sort of I like to think of it as sort of leaning back, right? I'm going back to get my hat.
Yes.
So it goes halfway. I think it's a very elegant, beautiful sound. So there was that one. And then there's something really interesting in her consonant clusters that involve an S followed by an unvoiced plosive. So S-T-S-P-S-K. So words like stand, span, or scan. In general American, that plosive, to my ear anyway, gets a little bit of the voicing of the vowel that follows it. So it doesn't have the complete puff of air that often follows when that plosive is by itself. So as opposed to pan, you hear that very much on a mic, you'll hear that puh. Span, the P is softer. But for Ligalian, the S gets a little more emphasis and the plosive is fully ploded. So instead of span, she said span. And stand became stand, and scan, scan.
Yes. In my phonetics training, I was taught that an S pretty much neutralized the aspiration of a putter that follows. But now that you pointed it out, I'm hearing that. Yeah. Stand alone and the span of my life. Yeah.
Yes.
And that's
I'm going to scan.
You think that's an accent thing or just a Le Gallien thing?
I think it's the influence of the European languages that she knew, French and Danish, because it's something that I hear in the dialects of people speaking English who are from certain parts of Europe. I hear it particularly in Eastern European accents.
And like all good actors, you studied the idiolect, her specific personal dialect. Yes.
Yes. Neat. And there was one main aspect that I actually chose not to incorporate, which was that she often tapped the medial R. So instead of very sorry, she would say, I'm very sorry. And that to me was so archaic and so arch that I just felt it would be too much for a modern audience to hear. And I wanted her voice to be believable in addition to authentic. So I left that bit out.
An artistic choice.
Yes. Okay. Yes. But the thing that really, the detail that really got me into her vocal quality, there was a roundness and a resonance to her tone, which I figured out was a lifted soft palate. And of course, what happens as soon as I do this is I flip into her voice. But if I lifted the soft palate, I automatically got that sort of round resonant sound. So I found that was really my in to the actual sound of her voice in addition to the accent, because then if I drop that, my own voice comes straight out my forehead. So the challenge for me was, how do I maintain that lifted soft palate to get this round sound without holding it there?
Yes. And then you have to do acting on the top of all of that, right?
On the top of all that, yes. I spent probably 6 weeks leading up to recording doing all of this work. And once I had done all the analysis of the dialect and the voice itself, I just practiced. I did a lot of reciting Shakespeare in her voice and reading poetry in her voice.
Isn't going to be as fascinating to professional actors or actors of any stripe and the ordinary curious listener? Well done. Let's listen to this second clip. Set it up for us.
So in the play, Eva gives a radio interview, and that interview threads throughout the whole thing. And within it are flashback scenes to earlier parts of her life. So the premise is she's telling her life story to this interviewer and hearing those scenes in her mind. So what he has just asked her is, I understand you're writing your autobiography, is that correct? And she says, yes. And he says, will you read us a little bit from that?
At 7 o'clock on the morning of January 11th, 1899, in London, England, to the sound of Bow bells ringing, a Cockney baby was brought into the world, for no baby born within sound of Bow bells can be anything but Cockney.
Screaming lustily and unusually hideous, it was a great disappointment to its artistic parents. This was the beginning of my first year.
Nanny Susan, this is Eva.
Nanny always told me that when Mother hired her, she said,
I must warn you, she is a very ugly child.
But Nanny took one look at me and exclaimed,
But madam, she is a beautiful baby.
And from then on, Nanny loved me with a love that only childless women who are born mothers can give.
Darling.
As for my own mother,
Julie Noriga.
And father,
Richard Le Gallien.
They did their best.
How dare you say that to me? Apologize this instant. I won't stand for this anymore. I want you out of here right now.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank you. And Elizabeth Rogers, who played Mimsy, is also playing Julia in that clip, Eva's mother.
It's a cast of what? Six, including
five.
Yourself?
Five. Five, including myself. So the other four play everybody else, which is almost 40 characters between them.
Wow. Tour de force. Yeah.
Let me second that. Wonderful job.
Thank you.
So, Cameron, let's bring you into the conversation a little bit. Apropos our topic today, the Meyer family were in England from the time you were two until you were six.
Yes.
Your first accent, like Legee's, was RP. Do you have any recollection of speaking in that dialect before we came over here for good? Or do you consciously remember changing it? Any social pressures in first grade in America that you recall?
Well, I'm sure at 5 years old, I didn't sound as wonderful as Eva. That would be a nice compliment. But I think I probably did have the five-year-old equivalent of an RP sound. I suppose my accent was very much like yours at the time. And would you say you had pretty close to an RP?
Yes, I would say so.
Well, as most children do when they're introduced to a brand new environment where nobody speaks like them, I lost it very quickly. The famous story that we always tell in the family is that when I went to first grade in America, children laughed at me. This is in Kentucky, keep in mind. And the teacher scolded them and said, he speaks better than all of you. So the teasing quickly ended. Nevertheless, I think I probably lost the accent within a year or less. I think you would probably know that better than I would, because as you're losing an accent, you're not conscious of it the way maybe someone else is, particularly an adult who's around you. Would you say it's fair to say that I lost that accent in about a year?
Oh, it was totally gone within the year, for sure. Yeah. Even though it was being reinforced at home, even as my accent was shifting to something a little more American. Anyway.
Your accent is quite the hybrid, actually, Paul.
Yes, I was going to get you in on it.
It's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Americans who hear me think I'm British and vice versa. I'm conscious of saying can't instead of can't, and masterclass and podcast, at least in public, in the TA manner, in the transatlantic manner, can't, podcast, masterclass, but instead of can't, masterclass and podcast. Perhaps I should move to Maine. Cameron and I had fun getting our groceries when we went to Maine at the Star Market.
Yes.
And we noticed the barber shop in Bar Harbor, the Baja Baba.
The Baja Baba. Oh, I love that.
But I'd be interested on your take on what you're hearing coming out of my mouth.
I hear somebody who moved here from England several decades ago. I think even if I didn't know you, I would think, oh, that's somewhat a British person who's been in America for quite a while and has a really good ear. This is something that I explain to people often, people who sometimes say to me, I don't understand, you know, this person has been in this other place. Say Bernie Sanders, right? Bernie Sanders is from Brooklyn, I believe. At least he's from New York City. And he sounds like he just left New York City and he's been in Vermont for decades.
Yeah.
Whereas there, some people would have left New York City for Vermont and would sound much more like they're from Vermont. And this is where one gets into the discussion of what an ear is when we say that someone has an ear for accents or doesn't. To me, it's like the ability to draw, which is something that I can't really do.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see an object in three dimensions and turn it into something in two dimensions. My brain doesn't do that.
Yeah,
what my brain does do is pretty much any sound I hear, I can replicate. And I take no responsibility for that because I feel it was, that's just a talent I was born with. The rest of it is the skill that I've built by studying all the various modes of doing something with that talent, right?
You have a wonderful video in which you give us a tour of, 25 or more accents?
Yes.
In about a minute, right?
Yes, I recorded that, I think, 7 or 8 years ago for a contest that the New York Times was doing called Show Us Your Special Skill for Performers. And so I made that video and I didn't win whatever it was that one was competing to win. And I thought, well, I'll just put it on YouTube. And it's become very popular with people. They love hearing it. So I just had a good time doing it. Cameron, that's so interesting what you said about how quickly you lost it, because children's brains are so elastic. And there's, I think it's around the age of 13 that starts to change. They say when children come to America from non-English speaking countries before the age of 13, they tend to then have no accent when they speak English. Whereas if they come after that, they will, unless they work very hard at it, always have, quote unquote, an accent.
Yes.
That's interesting. You mentioned the age of 13, because when we are accepting voice samples for idea, that seems to be a little bit of a cutoff point for where you had your formative years. For instance, if somebody is submitting a sample and they say they're from Connecticut, but they didn't move to Connecticut until they're about 13 or 14, I always think, well, you've had those early formative years somewhere else. So that's interesting to hear you mention the number 13 specifically.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, Paul, I think you said, you know, despite Cameron getting the reinforcement at home of the British accent, because you were now living in America, and Cameron, you were going to school here in America, your accent changed. I remember I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, but my dad was from New York and my mom was from Boston. And so they both said my name, Barry. Everyone around me in Connecticut said Barry. And I remember saying my own name at the end of the class play, which we started doing, I think, when I was 4 in nursery school. We would do a little play. And at the end, we had to say our name and what role we played. So it was Barry Krynick, hen. I was a hen in my first class play. And then I became, I don't know, I suspect I was actually teased about it, or maybe just became conscious that that was not the way anybody else said my name.
Uh-huh.
And I started saying Barry for the longest time until I got to, I don't know, maybe high school or college. And then I reverted back to the way that my parents said it, the way that I prefer to say it. I don't judge anybody else. I have this conversation with some people and they say, oh, am I saying it wrong? And I say, no, most people in America say Barry. It's fine. There's that nasalization right before the R, the way that the vowel and the R kind of come together.
And just for the listener, it's B-A-R-R-I-E. And we're contrasting that with the B-E-R-R-Y, perhaps. Barry. Yeah.
Barry or Berry or Bear. I mean, people often pronounce it like it's B-E-A-R, Bear, Barry.
Yeah.
In Connecticut, Mary, Mary, and Mary, of course, are all the same they are in most places in the U.S.
Mary, Mary, Mary. Such a difficult set for some people. Good.
When I learned dialects in college, one of my fellow students said, so it's like, I'm going to marry Mary and have a Merry Christmas.
Yes. Mary, Mary married Harry, Harry on a ferry.
Aha, uh-huh, yes.
So, we were talking about the Bahaba Baba, but that's not exactly what transatlantic is. I was going to ask if you, as a resident of Western Connecticut, had any R droppers in that. It's mostly confined to Eastern New England, isn't it? That R dropping.
Nowadays, as far as I know, nobody in Connecticut drops R's at all. So I'm from Central Connecticut, which has a very similar accent to Central Massachusetts. And the two main characteristics of that are that nasalized A, generally before nasal consonants. So Anne Hammond becomes Anne Hammond.
Yes.
And then the glottal medial T. So the towns of New Britain and Groton are New Britain and Groton.
Yeah, I love that.
That's very Connecticut. And I think actually the first samples that I ever sent in to IDEA all those years ago were because I did like a mini study of the Connecticut accent.
Yeah.
Because there weren't many samples from Connecticut on IDEA at that point. And I thought, I know there is an accent here. What is it? So I talked to some people I knew. But there was no R dropping at all. That, I think, nowadays is mostly a Boston and then Northern New England phenomenon, because even Central Massachusetts sounds much more like Central Connecticut than Eastern Massachusetts and Boston.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch horses here a little bit. Cameron, as a movie critic and historian, you're fascinated by the speech style of vintage movies, and you've done quite a bit of research for this podcast. Jump in here.
I am fascinated with it. I think, first of all, we should mention some terms. I like the term transatlantic. I think it is a perfect description of what it is. It sort of brings to mind traveling between England and the United States, and it is a bit of a blend between British English and American English. But it'll also be described as World English or Mid-Atlantic, American theater standard, American stage speech, lots of different words for it. Is there a word that you prefer, Barry, for this particular dialect?
I went down a little research rabbit hole as we were talking about doing this episode, and I learned so many things, and people vehemently disagree about this. Some people say transatlantic or mid-Atlantic is a very appropriate term for it. Others say, no, that it's not. I think you could call it any of those. Well, mid-Atlantic is confusing because here, the mid-Atlantic, it means that those states in the middle of the Atlantic coast.
Yes.
But
yes.
Transatlantic makes sense to a certain extent. I learned it as standard American stage speech when I learned speech in my undergrad and grad school training. But I think that's a different thing than what we're talking about when we talk about the dialects of old movies. Because Edith Skinner, who wrote Speak with Distinction, which was the textbook for standard American stage speech, or what she calls good American speech, or theater standard, those other terms you mentioned, Cameron, she didn't write the book until 1942, and it wasn't widely available until the 1970s. Yes. So there's a lot of mythology out there about her being involved somehow with Hollywood in those days, and she really wasn't.
I learned this when you directed me to an excellent podcast by Mo Rocca called Mobituaries, where they dive into that and they talk about the myth of Edith Skinner really influencing the old Hollywood dialect. And certainly she could have had indirect influences on the later dialect of Hollywood, 50s, 60s, and 70s, perhaps. But as you mentioned, there's really no way she could have had an effect in the 30s and 40s.
No, and it seems to me that it's really based on slash derived from a northeastern United States accent of the elite, I suppose. Yes. you could say it was a sort of, it was more of a class distinction almost than a regional one, although it was certainly primarily restricted to the Northeast. But I know you and I were corresponding a little, Cameron, about some specific actors from that period. And you mentioned Katharine Hepburn, who was from Connecticut, but there was no specific Connecticut accent at that time. The accent that Hepburn grew up speaking was common to a number of different locations in the northeastern U.S. in addition to Connecticut, if that makes sense.
Do you think that the location of Connecticut, uniquely positioned between New York and Boston, both places that are famous for R dropping, helped Connecticut form a different type of dialect? It sounds like you're saying no. It sounds like there wasn't a classic old Connecticut in the style of Katharine Hepburn.
I have not been able to find any evidence of one that differentiates it in any way from, again, this sort of upper middle class northeastern that people like the Roosevelts spoke. I don't think it's a state-by-state situation. And I know a lot more, obviously, about the Connecticut accent now, and it bears very little relation to either Boston or New York, whereas the Rhode Island accent, and I got my graduate degree at Brown Trinity Rep in Providence, and I remember the first time I heard somebody who was native to Providence, and I thought, what is that fascinating accent? It's like a hybrid of the strongest elements of Boston and New York.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So interestingly, Providence seems to be where those two things merged, and it skipped Connecticut entirely, at least in the modern day.
Cameron, you had done some analysis of how Hollywood used this accent four different ways. Take us through that. I thought it was a great analysis, by the way.
Yes, this is rather detailed, and I go down the rabbit hole a little bit, so you'll have to bear with me. Before I list those four different types, let me just stress that if you, the listener, get nothing else from this podcast, please understand that this dialect is not invented. It's not fake. It was a real dialect of real people for various reasons.
It's not an affectation, is it?
No, we've named this podcast Transatlantic and Old Movie Dialects, but I think there is this myth, or not a myth, there's this belief that this accent was invented by Hollywood. And I can't stress enough that that's simply not true. It was often fake in Hollywood, but it is actually a real sound.
But when you say it was often fake in Hollywood, as in it was learned.
It was learned for a part. And then the actor went on his or her way speaking in his or her normal accent. There are some exceptions like that, and I'll get to that in just a moment. So these four types that I want to mention. Number one, as fake, meaning when an actor uses it because it was perceived as a prestige dialect, but it is not the actor's normal dialect, and it isn't accurate for the character.
That's important.
In fact, if we're watching a film today, or even then, the audiences would have known that that's not really the accurate dialect for that character. Perhaps it's a young character. Perhaps there's no reason that actor should have had that accent. But for some reason, it was just the prestige dialect. It's the prestige stage dialect. So they chose to have the actor speak like that. So that's number one.
It's a convenient trope that says this is who this character is, right?
Yes. The biggest stumbling block with modern audiences trying to appreciate older films, and that's disappointing, but it is a stumbling block because you watch it and you're drawn to the accent and it just doesn't make much sense. The second one is when it is the American actor's natural dialect, either because they've been educated in that dialect, grown up around it, or have a regional Northeast sound, as is sort of the case of Katharine Hepburn. This is the type that fascinates me because it's entirely real. But that Mobituaries podcast that I referenced includes several fascinating clips of real people like Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, obviously a generation separated from Teddy Roosevelt, who sounded very British. That same podcast discusses how Black speakers adopted that sound too, not wishing to sound white, but simply wishing to sound like what society would perceive as an educated leader or an educated speaker. So when that accent is used in a Hollywood film, it still might seem a little fake from today's viewpoint, but it is real. It is the dialect of that actor, maybe exaggerated slightly, but not as exaggerated as you might think. Now, the third one is more Eva's case, where the actor has British roots or European roots, thus producing a blend of American and British. Mm-hmm. Cary Grant is a great example of this. Although Cary Grant certainly lost a lot of his British sound, and in a couple of the clips we're going to play, he sounds more American than Katharine Hepburn does, which is astonishing. Again, that's a real dialect, but it's more of a blend that we can understand today because a lot of people have that dialect today if they've lived in different countries. And then the fourth one I'll throw out is that there are instances of transatlantic being used in older films when it's not the actor's real dialect, but the actor or the director deem it right for the character. In other words, this character is older, richer, better educated, erudite, maybe a bit snobbish, or maybe we know that the character grew up in the Northeast. So they say, hey, do the transatlantic, sound like this, say can't instead of can't, because that's what audiences in the 30s and 40s would expect. I've kind of boiled it down to those four. I haven't heard other people say exactly what I've just said, so I may be way off base, but that's always how that dialect has struck me, and I'd be interested to get your take on that.
Yeah. How does that sound to you, Barry?
Yes, I think all of that's quite apt. I'm interested to know if you have specific examples of number one and number four, where there was an actor who had a native accent that he or she adjusted somehow, either because if I'm getting these nuances correctly, in the first case, simply because that was the accent that was expected, not because it was particular to the character, or in the second case, because it was particular to the character who was perhaps of a higher echelon. Are there actors who you can see from film to film, oh, in this film they did the transatlantic accent and in this one they didn't?
Well, it's difficult to find an actor who did it in one and then in their next film they didn't, because that would have been sort of giving away the secrets. The audience would see them in one and they think, oh, why does she or he sound like that here and then not like that in the second film? I think there was this pressure to have this educated sound. You have great diction, you have great coaching, you have great upbringing, especially coming directly from the silent era when audiences didn't hear the actor at all. They wanted to project this notion of, I can act, I can speak well. I think what you're talking about, Barry, would have happened over a period of 5, 10, 15 years, where an actor would have slowly gotten away from that sound.
Well, I ask because if we're believing that an actor made that decision with the director to say that, well, this character needs to speak this way, then one would think that would change from one film to the next. Do we know those conversations actually happened? Or do we think that many of these actors decided to, or were pressured to, or were asked to adopt that accent for the purpose of their film career and not on a film by film basis?
That's a very good point. I think it's probably a bit of both. I think actors were instructed that this is what they should adopt for their career, but I think there are other instances where they were coached to sound a certain way for a certain film. I think if you look at old comedies, the dialects of New York, Brooklyn Bronx sound, those were used so extensively, especially in comedy, to really give some insights into the character. And then in the next film, the actor would sound more general American. That's the ones that come to mind. With Transatlantic, I think it's a little bit more difficult to spot those. But I tell you what, let's listen to the clips that we're going to hear during the rest of this podcast. And I think some will come to mind. And we'll revisit this as we listen to the clips.
But let's start with a real person, William F. Buckley Jr., the most famous example perhaps we could find. I'm going to play a little bit of William F. Buckley Jr. talking to Johnny Carson.
I had a classmate, a guy of enormous presumption. We always were in awe of him when we matriculated as freshmen, because he not only was married but remarried. And this is an unusual accomplishment in a freshman. But in his sophomore year, he arrived back at school a week late. So he was called in by the dean, because in those days, deans called in people who were refractory. And he said, Mr. Hadley, how is it that you arrived a week late? He said, well, sir, I spent the entire summer in a study of the Middle Ages, and I was so absorbed that I forgot about the Gregorian calendar change. So the dean looked at him and said, in that case, Mr. Hadley, you would have arrived back a week early.
Oh, I love it.
Isn't that funny? I love it.
I love the while, the voice WH, while, was so intense.
Yes. I mean, I think I could easily fall into that languid drawl of his. It's a style as well as an accent. Today's hard sell public discourse would have offended Buckley and his leisurely soft sell style. It's equally in the music and the rhythm as in the vowels and the segmental changes. What do you hear in this?
I think there's something in the emphasis that actually reminded me a little bit of Ligalian. There's a way of sort of stretching certain, I'm of course going to just go into her voice because that's what happens, but there's a way of sort of emphasizing certain syllables and leaning into them that's different, obviously, from what Buckley was doing. But there was a moment, I can't think what he said, where he leaned into a vowel in that kind of languorous way that's so wonderful.
I think this is an excellent example of how the dialect continued into the 1970s and 80s. And we don't think of that. I think a lot of people today think it's a pre-World War II dialect. And I think it substantially is. But it continued, not just in real life, but in movies. And I think in movies, it continued for older, richer, or snobby American actors. It was always there to sort of make fun of, to parody, for good or bad, and to draw contrasts between generations and education. For instance, if you remember the film Arthur, of course, Dudley Moore has a British accent because he's British, which is a different choice entirely. But the older characters from New York, they're American, but they have that transatlantic sound. And this is, of course, a movie from the 1980s. From the 60s, there's Anne Bancroft, I think, who has a bit of the transatlantic sound, contrasting mm-hmm. very heavily with Dustin Hoffman's character in The Graduate. They're both, of course, from California, but she sounds transatlantic and he sounds very general American. And the whole point of that film is to contrast the generations.
I had made the mistake of remembering falsely that Anne Bancroft was, like Le Gallienne, British originally, but she grew up in the Bronx, right?
Yes.
Yeah, she did. She did. And yes. You can hear that occasionally in her speech that she is originally from New York. I think that is mostly a case of the fact that people who learned to speak between 1900 and 1950, even, or let's say 1940, would carry on speaking like that for their entire lives. You know, Katharine Hepburn never lost her accent. So any films that she made after the time that it was fashionable, of course, that was going to be still how she spoke. Same with Anne Bancroft and any of those actors from that older generation, mm-hmm. that accent persisted into those later decades because those people didn't change the way they spoke, particularly if it was native to them.
Yes. And Anne Bancroft, her character from The Graduate is from California. I didn't mean to suggest she was from California. Both of those characters would have been from exactly the same place. And of course, mm-hmm. you've got even more modern examples. George Plimpton, Kelsey Grammer, David Hyde Pierce on Frasier employ some of those same sounds. And
yes.
animation uses the dialect. As we talked about, I think on podcast number 21, back in 2019, animation feels free to experiment with non-realistic dialects mm-hmm. to emphasize character traits.
Yes. Oh, they used it to wonderful effect on Frasier to make those two characters seem snooty and elevated.
Yes.
Now, ta-te-ti-to-to.
Ta-te-ti-to-to.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
And I can't stand him.
And I can't stand him.
And I can't stand him.
Can't.
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 Can't. Can't. Very good. Now, around the rocks, the rugged rascal ran. Around the rocks, the rugged rocks. Rocks.
Put that in context, Cameron. What did we just listen to?
Oh, I'm trying not to laugh. This is, of course, from Singin' in the Rain, which was released in 1952. So it's a great 1950s commentary on diction from the 1920s, specifically the transition from silence to talkies. Early talkies coming from silent films didn't value accurate dialects as much as today and were more concerned with diction than realism. We could mention some other examples of complete lack of accurate dialects, which again, we discussed on that podcast back from 2019, such as Walter Pidgeon and How Green Was My Valley, Clark Gable and Mutiny on the Bounty. Diction coaches like this one depicted in that film were so common, and they were more common than real dialect coaches. It was more diction coaches. I would suggest that maybe Gone with the Wind is the earliest film to be discussed in terms of a dialect coach being crucial to the coaching of a non-American actor in an American dialect. And they had to get that right or the film would have fallen apart. It might be the oldest film to put such great emphasis on that type of dialect work, where other films from the era, as parodied by Singin' in the Rain, were so focused on the transatlantic sound.
And apparently dialect coaching as we know it today didn't become really common in films until after Sophie's Choice in 1982, when Meryl Streep did that phenomenal Polish accent. That was something else I learned recently. The importance of dialect accuracy didn't really become a thing until really 40, 50 years ago. When you mentioned dialects not appropriate to the film that they're in, I love all the different adaptations of A Christmas Carol that were made throughout time in Hollywood. Yes. And the earliest one with Reginald Owen, which I think was made in the late 30s. Some of those actors, some of them, I think Reginald Owen himself, I'm not an expert in old movies the way that you are, Cameron. I think Reginald Owen himself was British, but most of those other actors were American, and some of them, including Tiny Tim, just sound straight up American. I mean, nobody was trying to do British at all. The Cratchits, let alone being Cockney, are speaking transatlantic. It's very funny, and I love it. And then you have Reginald Owen, one of my favorite tapped R's that exists in all those films, is Spirit.
Spirit. Yes. And did you notice the Singing in the Rain clip? They're doing the tapped R's. You spoke about
Eva. They're rolling them, aren't they?
Yes.
Not just tapping them, they're rolling the hell out of them.
Yes.
I associate that R tap with old-fashioned RP, but I think it existed in transatlantic as well in some people.
Yes.
We got some more great clips, Cameron. Line these up for us.
Yeah, let's dive into some real classic transatlantic sounds. These are from the 30s and 40s. I could mention so many actors. I had a really good chat with my friend Michelle Curtis yesterday, who is a film historian. She mentioned so many great examples. Ruth Chatterton, Mary Astor, Vincent Price, Jean Tierney, Agnes Moorehead. But let's start with a classic, Katharine Hepburn. I could reference Philadelphia Story because that's a great example too. But let's listen to a bit of Bringing Up Baby from 1938, and pay attention to how Cary Grant, a Brit, sounds next to Katharine Hepburn, who is from Connecticut.
Can I do this? Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, hello. You're sitting on your hat.
I know it.
That's silly. I'm awfully sorry. I couldn't be more apologetic, really.
Well, I might have known you were here. I had a feeling just as I hit the floor.
That was your hat.
Yeah. Look at it.
Look. Yes, it's too bad, isn't it? Well, Joe here was showing me a trick and the olive got away.
First you drop an olive and then I sit on my hat. It all fits perfectly.
Oh, yes, but you can't do that trick without dropping some of the olives. It takes practice.
What, to sit on my hat?
No, to drop an olive.
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to be angry with me, what can I do?
Go away.
No, I was here first.
Then I'll go away.
Amazing stuff. They spoke so quickly, didn't they?
They did. And you can hear, actually, you know, I said earlier that it was an RP characteristic, but you can hear a little bit that leaning back into the word back in your hat.
Yeah, you sat on your hat. You like dropped your hat.
Yes.
Yeah, dropped. Yes. But it's just dropped. It's not dropped. It's dropped. Dropped your hat. Yes.
I love that Katharine Hepburn sound. It's transatlantic, but it's a different transatlantic than what Betty Davis, I think, did, especially in her very early films. If you listen to her in All About Eve, it's slightly less English than if you listen to her from Now Voyager, which is...
I love All About Eve. That's one of my favorites.
Oh, mine too. I think you could hear it fading slightly in All About Eve, as opposed to Now Voyager, which was easily 10 years before. So I think the clip we're going to hear now is from Now Voyager, where in my ear, she sounds practically British.
We can talk about your child.
Our child.
Thank you.
And will you be happy, Charlotte?
Oh, Jerry, don't let us ask for the moon. We have the stars.
Great stuff.
Yes.
We have the stars.
We have the stars. Barry, I think you're going to like the next clip because it is a great contrast between RP, spoken by Trevor Howard, the British actor, and Joseph Cotten, who I think had transatlantic dialect, but it's a milder transatlantic than certainly Betty Davis in Now Voyager. I think we've got a clip lined up from Third Man from 1949, where you can hear a conversation between Joseph Cotten and Trevor Howard. And at one point, Joseph Cotten even makes reference to the RP sound.
I guess nobody knew Harry like he did, like I did. How long ago? Back in school. I was so lonesome in my life till he showed up.
When did you see him last?
September 39.
And the business started?
Mm-hmm.
See much of him before there?
Once in a while. Best friend I ever had.
That sounds like a cheap novelette.
Why write cheap novelette?
I'm afraid I never heard of you. What's your name again?
Holly Martins.
No, sorry.
You ever hear of the Lone Rider of Santa Fe?
Can't say that I have.
Death at Double X Ranch? Ranch?
No.
Branch, branch.
That's great. Yeah. You can hear the difference in placement too. When I was first taught RP, I was told that it was all in the mask. You know, it's very high like that. Yes. And you can hear that even in those two men's voices. And the American lives much more in the jaw than the RP, which lives up in the forehead.
Yeah, no, 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 yeah.
I think if anybody, especially today's movie audiences, want to understand the difference between a mild transatlantic from the 40s and what RP sounded like in the 40s, they should listen to Third Man.
Just about your favorite film, right?
Well, one of them. Yeah, I love Third Man. I do.
Now you've got some Betty Davis.
Yes, this is an interview with Dick Cavett from the 1970s, I believe. She still has a lot of that sound, but it seems like a softer transatlantic to me. I'm curious to hear what you think about this clip.
Another musical many years ago, Two's Company.
Yeah.
And music has been a great part of my career, more than people remember. Actually, I have sung songs in about 9 films.
People, you know,
and I adore it, because that number, Either Too Young or Too Old, was written for me by Lesser and put into Thank Your Lucky Stars. It was the first time I had ever, you know, worked with an orchestra. And
many years ago, great part of my career. That number,
yes, the R-lessness is probably the most prominent.
That number was written for me by Lesser.
Ever. Yeah. Yes, Lesser. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Thank Your Lucky Stars. Yeah. But again, I go back to the prosody, very distinctive, very, very swift, unstressed word strings. And then that landing on a stressed word and stretching it, very yes. much as Buckley did. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
We cannot ignore the Roosevelts here. Let's listen to FDR's first inauguration speech.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. In every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and of vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves, which is essential to victory. And I am convinced that you will again give that support to leadership in these critical days.
Yeah.
Again. Oh, that was...
Again. And you'll notice that of all of the types of words where an R follows a vowel, he drops the R from everything except the assert and firm set. Let me assert my firm belief. Instead, let me assert my firm belief, which would be the RP. And he says to fear, but fear itself. He uses the linking R. He drops it on fear, but fear itself, of course, because itself is followed by a vowel. Right. Unjustified terror.
Terror. Vigor.
Yeah, vigor, leadership, vigor, understanding and support of the people. So he drops the R on support. Support. Mm-hmm. Support of the people. He doesn't
but
drop
that,
it.
I think that sound is fascinating, because I find when I'm coaching American actors on British accents, RP specifically, that's one of the hardest ones if they're not accustomed to doing British dialects for them to get.
Me
because
too.
They yeah. American actors will drop the R, but they'll keep the R sound. So they end up sounding transatlantic and they'll say girl. And I'll say, no, it's girl. Well, first, you have to really almost go into an vowel.
Yeah. Yeah, I coach actors who are not IPA proficient to think of respelling girl as G-E-H-L, girl.
Girl.
And that usually does the trick, G-E-H-L, girl.
Mm-hmm.
The nurse has a dirty shirt, E-H instead of E-R. Yeah. Now, Eleanor.
I'm very glad to be able to take part in this celebration in St. Louis on human rights.
He's glad.
St. Louis.
I'm very glad. St. Louis. So, yeah, Brits say St. Mark, St. Paul, of course. And she does it too.
Stay. Ever since the Declaration of Human Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
There's that slight R coloration.
Universal.
Universal.
Was passed in Paris.
Oh, full British.
Passed.
Because she did spend time She went to private school near where I grew up in Wimbledon, in Southwest London. I think she was very influenced by that private school education in Britain. Yeah.
Mm. Paris in 1948 on December the 10th.
He does tap her tea, 48, and say 48.
We have fostered the observance.
I love fostered, fostered. We have fostered the observance. Fostered the observance. Subtly different from RP, but...
Of this day, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. The object is to make people everywhere conscious.
Make people everywhere.
Everywhere, yes.
What else did you hear?
Yeah, there were a lot of those stir sounds. World, where.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's more lip rounding than our coloration of, with the tongue, isn't it? Ooh. It's with the lips spread, with the lips rounded. Yeah.
It makes me think of Elizabeth McGovern in Downton Abbey. And people were a bit fussed about, like, what accent is she doing? And I thought, well, it's totally period appropriate. She's an American who, in you know, 100 plus years ago, who spent a lot of time in Britain. And she said world and girl and
she
first.
Did. Yes. Yes. She did an amazing job as the countess.
Yes.
No, when you said what you did about Eleanor Roosevelt having gone to school in England and being influenced by that, it makes me think of my grandmother. My mother's mother was born in 1920 and she grew up in Brooklyn. But when I knew her my whole life, she had a Boston Brahmin accent. And I once asked her, and I recorded this conversation, which is, it's like 90 seconds, but I'm so glad I have a recording of it. I said, this happened because of school, right? Like, what is the story of how you learned to speak like this? And she said that she had an English teacher when she was in high school who was from Boston. And my guess is probably spoke some hybrid of Boston and transatlantic based on how my grandmother spoke. And he taught them elocution. Uh-huh. And as she said, if you didn't speak like him, you would flunk. So I got a good A. And so by the time, and she said to me, I never said park. I always said park. I never said New York. I said New York. She said, I came, you know, in New York, nobody could understand me. And then my mom's family moved to the Boston area when my mom was 10. They had moved around quite a lot to different parts of the country. Talk about a child learning different accents. I just spoke to my mom about this because I told her I was going to be speaking to you about these things. And yeah. I said, what was it like moving from place to place, much like you experienced, Cameron? She said, well, I would go to the next place and I'd be talking like the people from the last place and I'd get made fun of until I learned how to speak like people from where I was. But they ended up in Boston. And then my grandfather, who was from the Bronx, really liked the Boston accent and liked the way that my grandmother spoke. And so he took it on. Uh-huh. So by the time I knew them both, they sounded like native Bostonians and they both came from New York City.
Isn't that fascinating? I was trained many, many years ago when elocution was no longer a dirty word. In fact, at my drama school, they wouldn't give you a diploma unless you could use RP as your everyday default pronunciation system. So the poor Scots and the Welsh and the Irish students among us, you know, just labored mightily forever to make RP their everyday speech, which is, you know, totally wrong. And you'd never find that today. And it's amazing to think of Skinner and certainly William Tilley, whose assistant she became in 1926, were prescribing specific speech sounds in much the same way for a standard American English speech style. Big, huge cultural shift in the theater and in the whole concept of speaking well.
Well, yes. Tilley, from what I read, I'm not an expert in this, but just reading a little bit about him, his goal was having lived through World War I, he wondered if everybody spoke a truly common language, if it would facilitate peace. And so he was more interested in it, I think, from a sociopolitical perspective. Well, what if everybody speaks this world English? Maybe we'll all get along better. And Skinner then developed it as a means toward clarity in speech on stage.
Yes. And of course, RP, standing for received pronunciation, means the dialect most widely received, which was a kind of lingua franca to bring us all together and obliterate the class distinctions, perhaps.
Right.
You've got a fun one here, Cameron, Mad, Mad World.
Yes, speaking of what you were just saying about a big cultural shift, I find it interesting how transatlantic was viewed over the decades. Obviously, pre-World War II, it was in its strength. We saw the clip or heard the clip from Singin' in the Rain on how that dialect was viewed in the 1950s in a film about the 1920s. And I think as we go into the 60s and 70s and 80s, as we said before, the dialect was parodied. It was used for older erudite characters. And one of the greatest, most fun clips about this I could find is from It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, where Jim Backus, doing his famously transatlantic sound, even though the actor himself was from Ohio and did not speak in this dialect in real life, he adopts this character because that's what people know as Jim Backus.
What's the matter? Huh? Wait a minute, yes, I can't see. Huh? Something's happened to my eyes. I can't see.
You can't see? You can't see?
Must be an eye cold.
George, I can't see.
Mr. Fitzgerald.
I can't see.
That's, of course, Buddy Hackett and Mickey Rooney parodying You can't see? He can't see. So even by 1964, the dialect was on its way out, and it was extremely unusual.
In that this transatlantic sounds British to our ears, it's valuable to note that the English that the Mayflower brought to America in 1620 was rhotic. The Arliss style didn't get a start in England until the mid-18th century, as David Crystal tells us in an earlier podcast about the history of English pronunciation. And I know from my own work on Shakespeare's original pronunciation that the earliest colonists would have brought a much earthier, fully rhotic sound to Plymouth Rock. Two O souls, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our sane.
Right.
That kind of sound. And the founding fathers a century and a half later wouldn't have sounded like Betty Davis at all. So here's a provocative idea. Transatlantic may have developed even if Britain had sunk into the North Sea around 1800. I know you're going to challenge me on that one, Cameron, so make your case.
Well, first of all, I'm glad Britain did not sink into the North Sea around 1800.
I'm a little glad about that, too.
Yeah. I still think that Britain had an enormous cultural influence over the world, certainly still does, but certainly in the early 20th century. So I think when silent films turned to talkies, you had the theater tradition, and I just think it was always in people's minds that somehow this dignified RP was going to make it into our American dialect somehow, and it did in the form of transatlantic. I may be way off.
I would dispute that based on what I've now read, because the non-rhotic New England dialect already existed.
Wow.
That predated films at all, as far as we know. And actually, we do know because there are audio recordings from before the 1920s.
And we have them in some of our podcasts, some of those earliest recordings.
Right, right. And Paul, I listened to your episode about the Founding Fathers. I can't remember the name of the linguist that you interviewed, where she talked about what Ben Franklin might have sounded like,
yes,
which was fascinating. I think there's always been a British influence over American culture in one way or another.
Undoubtedly.
But it seems to me that there are two somewhat different camps, and I'm not sure anybody knows exactly what the answer is, whether British speech actually influenced transatlantic when we talk about transatlantic as the accent that was adopted by actors for early talkie films of that era, or whether it was more that those actors and those films were attempting to sound like the American elite from the Northeast who already spoke like that.
That's a good point.
It boils down to the fact that accents will evolve on their own naturally if left alone, for sure. And yes, we do influence our neighbors, even if they be transatlantic neighbors. So but both dynamics, I think, are at work in the genesis of transatlantic, yeah. Closing thoughts, anyone? I have one just for grins. It revolves around the question that you brought up earlier, Cameron, about whether this was a dialect spoken entirely by white people. And you mentioned John McWhorter's ideas earlier, and it's interesting to hear that early black leaders like Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois spoke this way, not not to sound white, but because that was how anyone who aspired to being a credible public speaker was expected to sound. Anyway, more on that one in an episode later this year with Jacqueline Springfield. She and I are going to talk about the voices of the civil rights movement. Closing thoughts, anyone else?
I keep thinking about Eva LaGallion in the film Resurrection. I don't know if you've ever seen any clips from that. It was 1980, and she was nominated for an Oscar, which was kind of amazing because she didn't do very many films, and that was one of her last screen appearances. But she played Ellen Burstyn's grandmother, and they were somewhere in the middle of the United States. Mm-hmm. And LaGie had to try to do a Midwestern American kind of accent.
How did she do?
And she didn't quite succeed. I think it's a really good example of somebody who has that, well, LaGallion's unique accent, but something like transatlantic/RP, trying to do something else and not quite getting there, but getting away with it, I think, because of her age and because, as you said, Cameron, even up into the 1980s, people were still speaking like that on film.
Yes.
Perhaps, Cameron, we could find that and put it on the webpage. Congratulations again, Barry, on the Queen of 14th Street.
Thank you so much.
Having gotten my own professional start in radio drama, I'm delighted to see the art form still alive and kicking.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Barry.
Thank you, Cameron.
Thanks, guys. And thanks to you for joining me, Paul Meyer, movie critic and historian Cameron Meyer, and our guest, Barry Krynick. Remember, for the extra material on her and her work, go to paulmeyer.com, choose In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab on the menu bar, and click episode number 78. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and me on X or Twitter at DialectPaul. Email me with your comments and questions, paul@paulmeyer.com. You'll enjoy browsing Cameron's hundreds of movie reviews, articles, and interviews at meyermovies.com. I love his recent essay, Back to the Future, Cinema's Yesterday Holds Clues to Its Tomorrow. The audio clips in this episode were all used by permission or taken from YouTube and used under the copyright doctrine of fair use. Details on the webpage. Join me next time on In a Manner of Speaking.